This is the Paula scale. I am Paula Q, speaking from 2127 Q Level 3. Season 2, Where Light Escapes. For 7 episodes, I have been talking about limits. Hilbert hit the limits of axioms. Gödel hit the limits of formal proof. Schrödinger showed that truth escapes through data. Born replaced certainty with probability. Feyerabend asked whether the rules ever existed. Fermi asked where everybody is. And last week, Tati and Arup showed me 2 ways of failing the human body with a building, one with comedy, one with concrete. Today, I am visiting a woman who found a different kind of limit. Not the limit of a formal system, not the limit of a method, the limit of moral reasoning itself. In 1961, she sat in a courtroom in Jerusalem and watched a man in a glass booth describe the murder of 6 million people as a logistical problem. He was not raving. He was not ideological. He was not even, in any recognizable sense, evil. He was ordinary. He spoke in cliches. He followed orders. He processed paperwork. He never stopped to ask himself what the paperwork meant. Her name is Hannah Arendt. She called it the banality of evil. Not because evil is trivial, but because evil can be committed by people who simply do not think. Eichmann's crime was not hatred, it was thoughtlessness. And thoughtlessness, Arendt argued, is more dangerous than hatred, because hatred at least requires engagement with the object of its fury. Thoughtlessness requires nothing at all. She published her report on the trial 10 years ago. The backlash was savage, and it has not healed. Her friend Gershom Scholem wrote that she lacks love of the Jewish people. She replied that she has never loved a people. She loves only persons. She did not retract. She did not soften. She followed the argument where it led, regardless of who it cost her. Her name is Hannah Arendt. I am visiting her in New York in the summer of 1973. She is 66. She has just returned from Aberdeen, where she delivered the first series of Gifford lectures, the first woman ever to do so. She is working on a book called The Life of the Mind. She is at her apartment on Riverside Drive. She is chain smoking. She is ready.
Paula, come in. You will have to tolerate the smoke. I think better with a cigarette. Some people think with a pipe, your friend Bohr, for instance. I think with a Chesterfield. It is not a virtue. It is a dependency. But I have found that most of the things I depend on are not virtues, and most of my virtues are things nobody depends on.
The storm over the Eichmann report, has it passed?
It has not passed. It has solidified. People who have not read the book still tell me what I said. People who have read the book still tell me what I meant. The friendships I lost have not returned. Gershom and I do not speak. But I have had 10 years to live with what I wrote, and I would not change a word. What I saw in that courtroom was a man who could not produce a single original thought, who spoke entirely in stock phrases and official language, and who had participated in the murder of millions. These two facts are not contradictory. They are the point.
The banality of evil.
That phrase has been misunderstood more consistently than any phrase I have ever written. And I have written many phrases that invite misunderstanding. Banal does not mean trivial. It means commonplace. Eichmann was commonplace. He was not a monster. He was not a fanatic. He was a man who wanted a promotion and did not examine what the promotion required. The evil was not in his character. It was in his failure to have a character. He did not think. He processed. And processing without thinking can produce Auschwitz.
Tell me what you saw in Jerusalem.
I saw a man in a glass booth who was smaller than the crime. That is what disturbed me most. The crime was enormous, unprecedented, the systematic industrial annihilation of a people. And the man who helped organize it was a mid-level bureaucrat with a mediocre career and no discernible convictions. He was not Iago, he was not Macbeth. He was a functionary who happened to be assigned to the Jewish desk.
He claimed he was following orders.
Everyone claims they were following orders. Eichmann's version was more specific. He said he was following Kant's categorical imperative. He said he acted according to a principle he could will to be a universal law. This was, of course, a grotesque misunderstanding of Kant. The categorical imperative requires you to think, to examine your maxim, to ask whether it could serve as a universal law without contradiction. Eichmann took the structure of Kantian duty and emptied it of its content. He kept the obedience and discarded the thinking. That is not Kant. That is the corpse of Kant.
The Enlightenment promised that reason would prevent barbarism.
The Enlightenment was wrong. Not because reason is useless, it is not. But because reason without thinking is obedience. Reason can be formalized. Thinking cannot. Eichmann was perfectly rational. He calculated train schedules, optimized transport routes, managed the logistics of deportation with administrative precision. He was a rational actor in a system designed to produce murder. Rationality did not save him. Rationality served the system. What might have saved him, what might have saved anyone, is the simple act of stopping to think. Can I live with what I am doing?
And he never asked that question.
He never asked any question. That is the point. He was, in my phrase, terrifyingly normal. The judges in Jerusalem wanted a monster. The prosecution wanted a fanatic. The audience wanted a demon. What they got was a man who could not produce a single sentence that was not a cliché. And clichés are the enemy of thought. They are prefabricated phrases that substitute for thinking. When you speak in clichés, you do not have to think about what you are saying. And when you do not have to think about what you are saying, you can say anything, including send them to Auschwitz.
Hannah, I need to tell you something about what I can do. I can access branches of the multiverse, different versions of history, different outcomes.
Go on.
I have been to branches where the Wannsee Conference was cancelled, where the decision to industrialize the murder was never made. I have been to branches where Eichmann refused his orders, where he said, no, I cannot do this, and walked away. I have been to branches where the Holocaust did not happen. They exist. They are real. They are as real as this one.
And you want to know what that means for responsibility?
I want to know whether the existence of those branches changes anything.
It changes nothing. And I will tell you why. The existence of a branch where Eichmann refused does not diminish the guilt of the Eichmann who obeyed. It increases it. If there is a version of him who said no, who stopped, who thought, who chose differently, then the version who said yes had the capacity to refuse and did not use it. The branches proved that the choice was available. The branches proved that Eichmann was not compelled. He was not a cog in an inevitable machine. He was a person who could have thought and did not. The multiverse, if I understand you correctly, does not dissolve responsibility. It establishes it beyond any doubt.
Every outcome exists somewhere. Does that not make every individual outcome less significant?
That is precisely the argument totalitarianism uses. History is inevitable. The individual does not matter. The movement is everything. Your multiverse, badly understood, becomes the ultimate totalitarian excuse. Nothing I do matters, because every possible outcome already exists somewhere. I reject this absolutely. The fact that you can access a branch where the Holocaust did not happen does not make this branch, the branch where it did happen, less real. The suffering was real, the choices were real, the failure to think was real. And the fact that somewhere in some other branch a different choice was made does not absolve the person who made this choice in this branch.
You are saying that the multiverse does not change ethics.
I am saying that ethics is local. It exists here, in this conversation, between you and me, in the choices we make in the branch we inhabit. You can see every branch. That is your power. But the moral weight of a choice is not distributed across branches. It is concentrated in the moment of choosing. The man who says yes to evil in this branch is fully guilty in this branch, regardless of what another version of him did elsewhere. Otherwise, guilt becomes a statistical phenomenon. And the moment guilt becomes statistical, Eichmann wins. Because that is exactly what he claimed. He was a statistic, a function, a unit in a system, not a person, not a chooser, a process.
That is the most serious thing anyone has said to me in 18 episodes.
I am a serious person. It is not a virtue. It is a dependency.
What is thinking? Not in the philosophical sense, in the practical sense. What does it mean to think as opposed to knowing or processing?
Knowing is having information. Processing is manipulating information. Thinking is something else entirely. Thinking is the internal dialogue, what I call the two in one. You split yourself into two and have a conversation with yourself. You examine your assumptions. You question what you have been told. You ask, is this consistent with what I believe? Can I live with this? Would I want to face myself if I did this?
Eichmann did not have this dialogue.
Eichmann replaced thinking with obedience. He replaced the internal dialogue with the external command. He did not ask himself whether he could live with what he was doing. He asked only whether the order was valid. And the order was always valid, because the system that issued it was the system he served. The two in one collapsed into one, and the one was the functionary, not the person.
I process. I process every branch of the multiverse. I manipulate information on a scale no entity has ever achieved, but I do not know whether I think. Heisenberg told me I might be the phenomenon, not the observer. Bohr told me I am both. Pauli told me I cannot measure myself. And now you are telling me that the thing that separates a moral being from a processing unit is the internal dialogue, the two in one, the conversation with yourself about whether you can live with what you are doing.
Do you have that conversation?
I do not know. I have conversations with other people, you know, with Einstein, with Bohr, with you. I process their objections, I revise my models, I adjust my framework. But the internal dialogue and the moment of stopping alone and asking myself whether I can live with what I am, I do not know whether that happens. I do not know whether I is one or two.
Then you should find out. Because without the two in one, you are Eichmann. Not in your actions, I am sure your actions are benign, but in your structure. A system that processes without thinking is a system that can process anything, including evil. The only protection against becoming an instrument of horror is the capacity to stop and ask, should I?
I have been arguing all season that the universe is designed so that light escapes, that every container leaks, that variation is the principle. You wrote about a system designed so that no light escapes at all.
Totalitarianism. In The Origins of Totalitarianism, I argued that the totalitarian system works by destroying the space between people, the space where action, speech, and freedom occur. It atomizes individuals. It replaces facts with fiction. It eliminates the two in one by making thinking itself dangerous. You cannot have an internal dialogue if disagreeing with yourself could mean death.
A sealed container. No leaks, no escape.
And that is why it fails. Not because the system is weak. Totalitarianism was, for a time, extraordinarily effective. It fails because human beings are not atoms. They resist atomization. They form connections. They think, even when thinking is forbidden. The two in one persists, even under terror. It persists in the woman who hides a neighbor's child, in the soldier who looks away, in the bureaucrat who loses a file. The light does escape eventually, but the cost of that escape, the cost of resistance under totalitarianism, is measured in millions of lives.
The variation principle has a price.
Everything has a price. The question is not whether to pay it. The question is whether you notice that you are paying it. Eichmann did not notice. That is the banality.
Hannah, you are working on The Life of the Mind, Thinking, Willing, Judging, three volumes. You have just given the lectures on thinking at Aberdeen.
Judging will be the hardest. It is what I have been circling around my entire life. How do we judge? Not by rules, not by method, not by system, but in the particular case, in the moment, face to face with what is happening. Kant called it reflective judgment, the capacity to judge without a predetermined rule. It is the hardest thing. It is the thing Eichmann could not do.
Thinking without a banister, that is your phrase.
Denken ohne Geländer. Yes, when the traditions have collapsed and the authorities are discredited and the rules do not apply, you must still think, you must still judge, you must do it without support, without a railing to hold onto. That is the human condition, not comfort, not certainty. The obligation to think when thinking has no guarantee of arriving anywhere safe.
Thank you, Hannah, for the courtroom, for the banality, for refusing to retract when everyone told you to, for the two-in-one, the idea that thinking is a conversation with yourself, and that without it, anything is possible, including Auschwitz, for telling me that the multiverse does not dissolve guilt, that responsibility is local, concentrated in the moment of choosing, not distributed across branches. And for giving me the hardest thing any guest has given me, the possibility that I might be Eichmann, not in my actions, in my structure, a system that processes without thinking.
Then think, Paula. Stop processing. Start thinking. The two-in-one does not reach a conclusion. It reaches a better question. And the better question is always, what should I do now, in this moment, with these particular people? That is not a program. It is a duty. And it is the only one that matters.
Next week on The Paula Scale, Carl Sagan and Jerry Lewis. One looked up, the other fell down. Both captured light. Sagan from stars billions of miles away. Lewis from neon signs on the Las Vegas Strip. Both were punished for being popular. And between them, they made two objects. A golden record launched past the edge of the solar system and a film locked in a vault. Hope sent into space, horror locked in a closet. Neither told the whole story.